From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. An onslaught from land, air, and sea, dwindling hope of rescue, a ticking time bomb for hundreds of thousands of soldiers. The World War II evacuation at Dunkirk has been dubbed a miracle. It's now an Academy Award-nominated film eight times over. The sweeping epic tells the story of the harrowing rescue by ordinary British citizens in small fishing boats. This hour on Point, Dunkirk on the big screen and its message for this generation. You can join us on air or online. Have you seen the movie? Do you know the history of Dunkirk? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at the evidence of a possible slave ship discovery in the waters off Alabama. Joining me first, though, from New York City to talk about Dunkirk is Kara Buckley, culture writer for The New York Times. Kara, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what do you think of the film?
I liked the film. I interviewed Christopher Nolan. I thought it was for Christopher Nolan. It was a shorter film. It was 2 hours long, and it used his sort of tricks of playing with time to create different perceptions of how chaotic those days were in Dunkirk for this mass evacuation. It was beautifully filmed. You know, it was in IMAX, and it really created a visceral sense of the tension. You know, all of these hundreds of thousands of Allied troops were encircled by Germans. And what Christopher Nolan did was he decided to make a war film with a lot of tension, but without a lot of blood. So you're looking at sort of a suspension thriller instead of a gory, you know, kind of an affront of a war film. So I thought it was a beautiful picture. What did you think?
Well, I loved it. We even took our young children to see it because I wanted them to understand the history of Dunkirk and really to know the sacrifice that went on to rescue those soldiers. I thought it was great. Let me play a clip here. Hundreds of thousands of men trapped on the beach at Dunkirk, surrounded by the Germans. Here's a clip from the movie. Two British officers, played by Matthew Marsh and Kenneth Branagh, deliberating on the British Royal Army coming to the rescue.
How long does London expect the army to hold out before we make terms?
Make terms? We're not stopping here. We need to get our army back. Britain's next, and then the rest of the world.
Christ. And you can practically see it from here.
What?
Home.
Filmmakers actually were on site, right, Kara? They filmed on the beach in Dunkirk with real boats and planes, instead of special effects. Tell me how that contributed to the tone, the feeling of the film, really being immersed there.
Right. Well, Christopher Nolan, you know, he really likes recreating authenticity. He wanted to use the actual beach. He was able to do that. He's a Brit, and he said, you know, this is a storied, less known to American audiences, but it's just deeply ingrained in British history, Britain's sense of itself. And so he really felt like, I can't mess this up. And also, he made it so tactile, again, with IMAX, you know, using some of the exact planes, replicas of the exact, you know, tiny boats that went out to save these soldiers. I mean, it felt fully immersive, and you sort of felt the claustrophobic effects, you know, if you're in a submarine going down. And that's exactly what he wanted to create. He wanted to create that sense of encroaching panic that the soldiers certainly felt with the Germans all around them.
Right. And here are the Allied pilots surveying the odds of the British troops' survival on the beach at Dunkirk.
Dunkirk's so far. Why can't they just load it carefully?
The enemy had something to say about it.
Down here we're sitting ducks.
Keep them peeled. They'll come out of the sun.
Kara, the movie is shot on large format film, which is unusual in our digital era.
Right. Now, this was something I have to say during my interview with Chris Nolan. I was just reviewing my notes. He went into such film geek detail about the shutter speed and this and that. And I sort of, even reading it over, I thought, good Lord, like if I was a film geek, maybe I would fully understand this. This was really important to him, though, to just sort of have, you know, this degree of specificity. He does not like 3D. He prefers shooting in something that will capture, you could see the fabric of the soldiers' clothes. You know, it was that sort of granularity that made it so real and so fresh. And he's very old school. You know, he is a huge cinema fan. He will, you know, bring up the name of any war film almost ever made as a reference. So this for him was very much important to go old school and to really be a purist on it.
You've mentioned Chris Nolan, the director. He's known for depicting this sort of fantastical, right? Dark Knight series, Memento, Inception.
Exactly.
How does this film compare to his previous works?
Well, I think, you know, I asked him, I said, exactly, you're known for, you know, the... He said, I always wanted to make this. 25 years ago, he and his wife, who co-produces the films, his films with him, they crossed the English Channel in a boat. A friend of theirs had a boat. They said, let's just go across the English Channel and see what it was like, you know, back in those days of Dunkirk around the time. The trip was supposed to take 8 hours. It ended up taking 19. It was harrowing. It was cold. They were scared. That's when he first got the idea. So that was it's cooking in his noggin for 25 years. He said, I really wanted to make a British film, but I needed American money. I needed an American studio backing it. So he made his other films, and then when he, you know, got the studio just to completely on board, was able to do this. So while he definitely loves exploring these other landscapes, these, you know, as you say, fantasy worlds, this was always a dream of his to make. And he also, you know, employed a typical Nolan device of playing with time. You're sort of disoriented. You know, some of the events take place over a week, and then you're with the pilot, whose events take place over the course of an hour, and then you're with the boats, which take place over the course of a day. So he's still playing with narrative. He's still interweaving them. He's still leaving the audience arguably slightly disoriented and trying to figure out, you know, what sequence follows what.
Mm-hmm. So it's up for 8 Academy Awards.
Yes.
Give us the categories.
Well, okay. The ones of note, the biggest, it's Best Picture, Best Director. And the remainder are sort of below the line, Best Sound Mixing, Score, Editing. This is the first time Christopher Nolan is up for a Best Director, which is kind of astounding, given his career, certainly not unprecedented for story directors to not be nominated for, you know, for their work for decades. So a lot of it is below the line, but I think, like I said, the Best Director is the biggest get for Christopher Nolan. His film Inception also is up for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. And again, for the more technical categories, for him to sort of make it into, you know, the top 5 directors, at least in the Academy's viewpoint, I think must be enormously satisfying for him.
Well, Kara Buckley, a culture writer for The New York Times, really appreciate your time and perspective on Dunkirk. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for asking.
Thank you. Joining me now from St. Paul, Minnesota, is John Broich, Associate Professor of British Empire History at Case Western Reserve University. You can link to his piece from Slate, What's Fact and What's Fiction in Dunkirk, at our website, onpointradio.org. John, welcome to the program. Great to have you.
Well, happy to talk to you, Jane.
Well, thank you. Set the stage for us. May, June 1940, the French port of Dunkirk, hundreds of thousands of soldiers stranded, penned in by the Germans. What happened?
Yeah, it all happened because of this German blitz across northern France from about 10th of May. They used their tanks as a spearhead, coordinating with fighters and bombers via radio on the ground in the tanks themselves. They had learned all this kind of coordination in their attack on Poland in 39. And the infantry and supplies were following the tanks. The French, on the other hand, were prepared for a more or less stationary affair, like World War I's Western Front, with which we're all familiar. Mm-hmm. And indeed, they built these massive fortresses along their frontier just for that kind of war. But the Germans weren't going to do that. They rolled the dice that they could pass through the Ardennes region, a place with not many roads and bridges, and they pulled it off. Mm. And so this slicing across northern France meant that the British and the French and British and French colonial troops and Belgian troops were cut off from supplies and communication, and things rapidly fell apart, especially for the French army. Some French commanders, like Charles de Gaulle, pushed for a mobile counterattack, and they fought bravely. They did their best, but things were just too uncoordinated by that time to capitalize even on some of the French's, some of the successes that the French realized.
Hmm. Well, what's so remarkable about the film with that as a backdrop is the hundreds of British civilians on leisure and fishing boats who came to the rescue of these soldiers at a moment of almost assured destruction. Were they asked to step up to the rescue mission, or did they choose to come on their own?
Well, there certainly were some civilian captains on those that fleet of little ships that ferried so many men off that beach to the destroyers and transports. But the majority of the little ships were piloted by Royal Navy personnel. And that's what's so fun in the film about the Mark Rylance character. He sort of slips away and says he's going to pilot his ship by his little boat by himself.
Mm. Well, we'll hear more of that heroic evacuation by British civilians after the break. We're getting ready for Oscar season, revisiting the history behind the movie Dunkirk this hour, and you can join the conversation. We head to break with Supermarine from the movie soundtrack. Composer Hans Zimmer is up for an Oscar. I'm Jane Clayson. More after this break. This is On Point.
It's Ophira Eisenberg, host of Ask Me Another. We headed out to L.A. for two all-celebrity contestant shows, and the competition was more intense than the traffic on the 405. Linda Cardellini, Jeff Garland, Lance Reddick, and Paul Rust. Only one took home an Ask Me Another Rubik's Cube. Find Ask Me Another on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Found it, 11 o'clock.
He's on me.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. Sound there from the battlefield of Dunkirk in Christopher Nolan's Academy Award-nominated movie. We're peeling back the history of this World War II touchstone, and you can join the conversation. History buffs, did the movie capture the spirit of that time? What's your question for our historians this hour? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're speaking with this this hour with John Broich, Associate Professor of History at Case Western Reserve University. And I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. From Raleigh, North Carolina, is Matthew Booker, Associate Professor of American History at North Carolina State University. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. So tell us what historical sources were drawn upon to make this movie so accurate.
Well, this is a place where John is actually an even better source for you, but it's clear that Nolan consulted with a variety, actually, of sources for this film. He consulted with professional historians, and he also relied upon a remarkable set of materials that John has written about on that Slate piece that you mentioned at the outset.
Let me play another clip, and we'll go back to John on these points. The French are beginning to lose control of the perimeter of the beach to the Germans. British Army Colonel Winant, played by James Darcy, rushes to the dock, the Mole, as it's called, hoping to see British warships on the horizon. Also watching the horizon, Commander Bolton, the Navy officer in charge of the evacuation. He's played by Kenneth Branagh.
Where are the destroyers?
There'll be one soon.
One.
After yesterday's losses, it's one ship on the Mole at a time.
The battle is here. What the hell are they saving them for?
The next battle. The one from Britain. It's the same on the plains.
They need to send more ships.
They've activated the small vessels pool.
Small vessels?
It's the list of civilian boats for requisition.
Civilian? We need destroyers.
Small boats can load from the beach.
Not in these conditions.
But I'd rather face waves than dive bombers.
John Broich, we need more ships. Civilian, we need destroyers, is what he said. And so the heroic evacuation begins. Tell us about that. Describe that heroic moment, that evacuation by British civilians in their small boats.
Right. So that's a really good capture in the film there, because the British really did have to hold back their most modern destroyers and planes to keep them away from the German onslaught so that they could fight on. So, indeed, so those small ships come across the channel, and as indicated in that clip, one of the moles was badly damaged. That is, this long key extending into the sea, where deep-hulled ships could approach the beach.
Right.
And they depended on those small ships to ferry the men off the beach to the bigger ships. And indeed, occasionally those small ships would make the crossing across the channel itself in those high seas that Chris Nolan apparently personally experienced. So 6,000 men owed their lives to those ships making the entire crossing themselves. Mm.
Historians have called it the miracle at Dunkirk, John Bruegg, and the Dunkirk spirit. Tell us about that, what that exactly means to the Brits.
Well, you know, even Churchill himself, who was, you know, this pugnacious optimist, at the beginning of Operation Dynamo thought he might be able to take 40,000 troops off that beach. And in fact, they took over 300,000 British and Allied troops across that beach. So perhaps that qualifies as a miracle, but it certainly qualifies as bravery, stick-to-itiveness. And so I guess the spirit of Dunkirk is just that. Keep fighting, even in the face of overwhelming odds. Keep trying, because you might just pull something off like this.
A coming together sort of in times of adversity, right? Yeah.
Indeed.
Let's get David in here from Hickory, North Carolina. Hi, David. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I've got a story I can relate from my own family's history.
Oh, terrific.
I had an uncle who was at Dunkirk with the British Army, and he was injured in the retreat, and he was lying by the roadside, and a German Army officer strode up beside him and pulled out his sidearm. My uncle thought he was about to be shot, and the German held the pistol above his head, and he said in perfect English, "This is for Churchill in 2 weeks' time." Then he reholstered his pistol and walked on, and German Army medics came and treated my uncle, and he said the German Army medics treated him very well.
Hmm. Ah, what a memory. What a memory. David, thank you very much. Let's go to Nate in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Nate. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I have a comment and a bit of a question. A social studies teacher of mine years ago actually made the offhanded remark that he thought a movie ought to be made about Dunkirk, and now it actually has been. My question was, because my understanding of the numbers were something like 200,000 British and over 100,000 French troops were rescued off the beach, is did they accurately portray the number of ships? Because I feel like there should have been more boats for that number of people.
Mm. Nate, good question. John Bruegg, was that portrayed accurately, the sheer number of boats that came to the rescue off the beach?
You know, that's a good point. And I'm thinking back now to this scene in the film where the little ships appear. And, you know, in reality, that's a bit of Hollywood. In reality, they all didn't make this sudden single appearance. But yeah, it should have been quite a massive flotilla of many hundreds of little ships. And I'm not sure that the film does quite depict that scale.
Nick, thanks so much for the call. Matthew Booker, I'm curious, you know, war movies generally focus on the dynamic action of soldiers. Think Saving Private Ryan or Hacksaw Ridge, right? Really, in this movie, there are no exciting attacks, no counterattacks, as our first guest, Cara Buckley, was talking about. You know, none of that, really. The main character, Tommy, never fires his gun. All the action of the film involves trying to get these soldiers off the beach as German bombers and U-boats pick them off. What's your take on that, your sense of this is sort of a war movie?
Well, this was one of my two favorite things about this film. The viewpoint that Nolan adopts, his cameras adopt, is striking. And yes, it has in common the first-person view that Saving Private Ryan did. But the difference is that these men are heroic, ultimately, because they survive. It's the act of survival which is the true heroism in this story, as the final scenes make clear when the men are actually somewhat ashamed. Some of the survivors are ashamed to have survived, unlike the stories they think of heroism, right, which is to die in battle and not to survive. Mm. So the film is wonderful for that because it really gives us, I think, a sense of war that is easy to avoid in war movies, perhaps even uncomfortable. And that is the absolute chaos, the horror, the violence that men inflict on one another in the act of survival. This is not a clean story about heroism. It's a story, I think, that's much more honest, perhaps, in what really happens in battle.
Let's get Joe in here from Decatur, Georgia. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Well, I guess my point is more about sort of the historical aspect of it.
Okay.
Weren't most of the boats at Dunkirk, you know, commandeered rather than volunteered? I mean, let's not pretend that if you were in Dunkirk Harbor and you didn't want to participate in the evacuation with your boat, that the British Army would just was like, okay, that's fine. And another point is that wasn't it a massive strategic blunder by the Germans not to attack Dunkirk?
Mm. Joe, thank you. 2 points there. John Broich, what about the first? Has Dunkirk been romanticized? Those boats were commandeered, not volunteered?
A bit, yes. It wasn't exactly that the little ships were commandeered with their crews. It's that Royal Navy personnel operated the majority of those little ships. So Joe makes a good point there. And then the second question about the German blunder, we could debate it. I think the conventional wisdom is that the Germans had to take care about thrusting their tanks too far ahead of their support. That is, the infantry coming in trucks behind them. Because an isolated tank is a pretty good target for infantry with anti-tank weapons. And it is true, and I actually believe that the film indicated this, that why waste tanks, why waste infantry if you can dive bomb the Allies on the beach at your leisure?
Joe, thanks for those good questions, those good points. Let me play another moment from the movie Dunkirk. One of the civilians who came to the rescue in one of those small boats is a Mr. Dawson, played by Mark Rylance. On the way to Dunkirk, they pick up a near-drowned soldier played by Cillian Murphy. Mr. Dawson attempts to calm him as the terrified soldier realizes that they are heading back to the beach he just escaped.
Where are we going?
Dunkirk.
No, we're going to England.
We have to go to Dunkirk first.
I'm not going back. I'm not going back. Look at it. If we go there, we'll die.
I see your point, son. Well, let's plot a course. Take your table out and warm up. Peter, have we got space for a man to lie down?
Then as Mr. Dawson, his son, and another boy head toward Dunkirk with the panic-stricken soldier they've rescued below deck, the boy, George, asks why the soldier does not want to return to the French shore.
Is he a coward, Mr. Dawson?
He's shell-shocked, George. He's not himself. He may never be himself again.
Matthew Booker, what do you make of that character and that moment in this movie and the general response at the time for soldiers who were, quote, shell-shocked? That was a real term.
This war and the Great War that preceded it really transformed, I think, the way that Europeans and to a lesser extent Americans appreciated, understood the experience of soldiers in war. The extraordinary violence that these men endured and inflicted it's not something that human beings can tolerate. People are not meant to behave and to survive these kinds of conditions. And so the things that we now take for granted since the Vietnam War and the Iraq War, that head injuries, that PTSD exists, these are still in play. They're still becoming understood. But this film does such a fine job, I think, of helping us to see into the experience of the individual. This is the, as I said, the thing I like most about it, that Nolan is able to put us in the world of people who are unable to comprehend what they're enduring.
Let's get Javier in here from Tampa, Florida. You're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi. My question was about the historical accuracy of the depiction of the Spitfire pilots' stories. One of the Spitfire pilots runs his plane out of fuel almost knowingly, and I thought that was kind of contrary to the history, at least in the Battle of Britain, of pilots literally dying on the airfield because the equipment was more important than the pilot.
Ah, interesting. Javier, thank you. John, set us straight here on the history.
Yeah, Javier makes a great point. Now, I have run across anecdotes of pilots holding out so long that they glided their planes back to their airstrips. So in the film, we do see a Spitfire gliding for a long time. And if we imagine that pilot had gained enough altitude, he could have glided for 15 or so miles. It's a bit of Hollywood at the end when spoiler here, when a gliding Spitfire shoots a Stuka out of the sky just as it's barreling down on Kenneth Branagh.
Javier, thank you very, very much for that. Let's get Dave in here from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Dave, you're on.
Yes.
Hi, Dave, you
yes,
there?
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. My comment is, and I'll respond to that last caller, I think people who were disappointed with the movie were sort of holding it to this standard of really holding to the history exactly as it happened. For example, a friend of our family was British. She was in London during the time of the rescue, and she was disappointed because it didn't tell that story. Where I really, from an artistic perspective, I feel like the director was really focusing on the emotion of these three characters, that the captain of the ship was a civilian and his sense of duty and honor, the pilot, his sense of sacrifice, that he was going to hold out as long as he could, and then the sense of panic, and as an earlier caller mentioned, the shame of having survived and what he did to survive, and being acknowledged by the World War One vet at the end. And a lot of the historical aspects were really told through the dialogue and not shown, I think, to, again, communicate the frustration of the officers who had to just stand there and wait.
That's a good point, Dave. Thanks for calling. Well, I guess I'm curious, John Broich, hearing Dave there, how does studying this specific battle help us better understand the larger history of World War II?
Well, I think it portrays this experience, this is the sort of thing that Matthew's been getting at, is that it tells us something about the experience of humanity. You know, Chris Nolan was explicit in saying he wanted to portray something about the sense of being hunted on that beach, and that's history. That's part of what we need to understand about World War II. Getting to the caller's point, the question of history, I give this a very high grade as a history of an experience. I mean, I could see veterans' recollections being depicted on the film, the listing of that hospital ship, the men who walked into the waves, the men and boys who tried multiple escapes. All that really happened.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're looking at the history behind the Oscar-nominated movie Dunkirk this hour, and you can join the conversation. Is this story of heroism and self-sacrifice a message for this generation? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We are speaking this hour with Matthew Booker, Associate Professor of American History at North Carolina State University, and with John Broich, historian of the British Empire at Case Western Reserve University. Let me play another clip from the movie. Here's a rescued soldier played by Cillian Murphy confronting Mark Rylance's Mr. Dawson, his character, as he rushes his little boat across the English Channel, demanding he turn that boat around and sail for England. Here's that exchange.
You haven't turned around.
Oh, we have a job to do.
Job? This is a pleasure yacht. You're weekend sailors, not the bloody Navy. And a man your age?
Men my age dictate this war. Why should we be allowed to send our children to fight it?
You should be at home!
Well, there won't be any home if we allow a slaughter across the channel.
And in the movie's finale, the British soldier Tommy is back on British soil on a train to London. He's gotten his hands on a newspaper and is reading aloud Winston Churchill's speech, calling on Britons to keep on fighting no matter what.
We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And even if this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world with all its power and might steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
Here's Chris from Facebook, who says, I was personally inspired by Dunkirk and especially by Churchill's speech read by a soldier at the end. Determination as a theme is something we need to see more of. Let's go to Laura in Cookeville, Tennessee. Hi, Laura. Glad you called. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm calling to give the viewpoint of a high school history teacher and how I handled Dunkirk.
Oh, good. Okay.
The high school students seem to have a real hunger to know everything they can about World War II, and they were so excited to finally get there. And, of course, this occurred at the beginning of the war, and I didn't have the movie 5 years ago to play for the kids, but I did have a clip from Mrs. Miniver, even though that's kind of old school. It still kind of set the stage and reminded the kids that even an ordinary citizen would have gone over. And their assignment was to either be a soldier left on the beach or a soldier rescued or a sailor picking them up.
Yeah.
Or at night, after they wrote that in class, that night they had to write a thesis about a theme, I should say, about what would have happened if they had failed.
And now you have the movie to show them, which you didn't have a few years ago. Laura, thank you for that memory, an American history teacher there. John Broich and Matthew Booker, talk to me a little bit about the soldiers from both India and Africa, African nations. They played a role in this battle, too, not necessarily reflected in this movie. Tell me about that, John Broich.
Yeah, and some of us pointed this out after the film. It would have been nice to see the battalion of the Indian Army who were on the beach depicted in the film. They stood out in soldiers' memories for their coolness. They were veterans of rough campaigns on the Afghan border. It would have been nice to have seen them. A lot of the soldiers defending the beach so that the British could escape were members of the North African Infantry Division. These are Tunisian, Algerian, Moroccan, Arab men and boys. And it would have been nice to see them. You might recall an early scene of one of the soldiers running through Dunkirk and getting to the beach. Well, those men at those sandbags probably would have been Tunisians.
Let's get Denise in here from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Denise. Welcome to the program.
Dunkirk is very emotive, I was told as a child. I'm moving ahead to the exact anniversary date, 26 January 1942, when the first American soldier landed in Belfast, Northern Ireland. Mm. And 50 years later, he came back to the same spot in 1992. So that was the beginning of the American participation in fighting in Europe. And may I say that there wasn't any conscription for anybody in Northern Ireland to fight because they were concerned there would be an invasion from the south across the border from the Irish Free State before it became a republic. Mm. And this land border certainly wasn't having a barrier like this proposed U.S.-Mexican thing, and this was a very real concern. There were 40,000 workers in Holland and Wolff Shipyard building those ships. And my mother and her friends were in the wages office and had to be evacuated out to a rural area, a big mansion house, to escape bombings. Wow. So that part of the United Kingdom suffered a lot, and yet there were six field marshals, including Montgomery, who fought Rommel in the African desert. Mm-hmm. My uncle volunteered. He was based in Tel Aviv, a British protectorate, and they were fighting Rommel in the African desert, which I didn't discover until after he was dead.
Wow, so you've got a lot of family history there, Denise. I really appreciate your call from Tampa. Our time is short. I wish we could go on here. Matthew Booker, the overriding theme of this film for you.
The other thing I loved most about this film, besides the depiction of individuals, which I appreciate, is the fact that we remember the past in at least two ways as historians. First, we think about accuracy. It matters to us, even that artists are faithful to the historical record. But the second way that we care a lot about the past is how it is remembered, how it is used. How is the past used to inspire or to tell us stories? You might think of this is myth, stories with a purpose. And this film, I thought, helped us to see how, and reminded us of a powerful English myth. It also offered us a view, however partial, into another set of understandings of this event, which is the French perspective. Hmm. And I thought John's points about those men and boys who died, unnamed, unremembered, largely except by the French, to save those British and Polish and, to some extent, French lives. That's another story, and it's another powerful myth, and it's one that the French remember. It's a memory of being betrayed by the British, and I think that's important too.
John, I'll give you the final word. Do you have one memory from the movie that sticks out to you as an historian?
You know, I liked that Chris Nolan tried to recuperate the memory of the RAF doing its best above those beaches under very bad circumstances. So I really appreciated that of Nolan.
John Vroig, a historian at Case Western Reserve University. I appreciate your time today and coming on and reflecting. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Matthew Booker, Associate Professor of American History at North Carolina State University. Matthew, thank you very much for your perspective.
A great pleasure.
Thank you. In a moment, listeners, wreckage of what may be the last American slave ship has been discovered in an Alabama River Delta. We'll talk about that. This is On Point. In a river delta near the city of Mobile, an Alabama news reporter has discovered wreckage of what may be the last American slave ship. Abnormally low tides following that bomb cyclone a few weeks ago that hit the East Coast exposed what could be the long-lost remains of the Clotilda. Joining me now from Mobile, Alabama, is Ben Rains. He's the Alabama.com reporter who discovered the shipwreck. Ben, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you, Jane.
So tell us about the Clotilda and why it's significant.
So this was the last American slave ship, and it actually came in 52 years after it was made illegal to import new slaves into the country. Slavery was still legal, but you were not allowed to bring slaves in. And so an Alabama riverboat captain and plantation owner made a bet that he could actually sneak a load of slaves in under the twin federal forts that guard the mouth of Mobile Bay. and, you know, it's a fairly wretched bet. But then he set out to do it and actually accomplished it. Mm.
So it arrived in Mobile. I think it had as many as 160 slaves on it.
110.
110. Okay, good. Thank you. And federal authorities caught wind of this illegal venture. And what happened?
Well, so the riverboat captain had stayed here. He hired another captain to go to Africa and bring them back. And he actually bought a ship to do this for $35,000, which in 1860 was an incredible amount of money. So when the ship came back, he knew he was being followed. He knew the feds were looking for him. The plan had been to bring the ship to his plantation, which is on a river, and offload the slaves. Instead, they snuck it in at night, and they actually used different river channels to sneak around the port of Mobile. They got up into the delta, which is a huge, vast swamp system. You know, think Okefenokee Swamp. And they offloaded the slaves under cover of night, and then they lit the ship on fire to destroy the evidence of their crime, because, you know, slave ships were notorious, but they smelled terrible. They just, you can imagine, with the crew, there were 125 people on this boat for months. So the slaves were then left in the swamp for 2 weeks while the plantation owner figured out where to take them, because he didn't want to get caught with them. So, you know, it was this really horrific end for these folks who were then enslaved for 5 years. But of course the Civil War happened, and after that they were free, and the story takes another turn there. You know, the end of the Clotilda being burned there in the swamp was actually the beginning of a community called Africatown. All these slaves suddenly freed first asked Timothy Mayer, the steamboat captain who had kidnapped them and brought them here, to send them home back to Africa. And he refused. So they then appealed to the U.S. government, which also refused, arguing you're not listed as slaves, because they weren't in the registries that were kept of slaves back then. You know, as property, they were labeled and things. And so they wouldn't even give them the proverbial 40 acres and a mule. So these captives actually, you know, some had trades they'd learned as slaves, blacksmithing stuff. They saved up some money together and actually bought a parcel of land from the plantation owner and made a community called Africatown, where they spoke their own language, you know, made their own schools, and lived apart as an enclave unto themselves. And it's that community is still there. Some of the descendants of these people brought aboard the Clotilda still live there.
Mm, what an incredible story. The hunt for this ship has inspired numerous searches over the years. Tell us how this ship was discovered.
Well, I'm a history buff, and I love a good mystery. And so I decided to look for it last fall. And I began by searching through the historical record to see what, you know, kind of the lay of the land, what had happened. And I found a number of things that, as an investigative reporter, really didn't make sense to me. And a lot of those things led all these other searchers to look in the wrong place. And they were also looking for the wrong size ship. So I, you know, had hunches about all that stuff, but then I did something else, and I started calling a lot of old-timers, including a man whose grandfather first bought property up in the Delta, like you could only get to this place by water, by boat. He was born in 1881, and so this family has had this property for a long time. I asked this guy, I said, do you happen to know where the Clotilda is? And he smiled and said, I think I do. And he told me to go to this very specific location. And I'd been there many times before fishing, but never on the kind of low tide we had during the big storm. So I knew January, we always have our lowest tides. And I had planned from the very start that I was going to look for it during those low tides in January. They were actually much lower than normal, thanks to the bomb cyclone. I found it the first day on the water that I went to look for it. Mm. And it was a stunning moment.
Wow. What was your reaction when you saw it?
You know, I was exhilarated at first, and then as I you know, studied the wreck and checked off the different historical items I knew to look for, things like threaded nuts and bolts, which weren't in use yet, and things like that, and I realized, okay, this ship is from the 1800s. This thing
wow.
is old.
Wow.
Then it became a sort of a more sobering thing, and I realized this is going to be a really powerful thing for many, many people. Mm. One of the things that helped me fully understand that was right before I went to look for it, about a week before, there was an episode of Finding Your Roots the PBS show
yeah.
with Professor Henry Yates, and they had a man on there named Questlove, who is the drummer for the Roots, the Jimmy Fallon house show or Tonight Show house
yeah,
band.
Yeah.
And he was on there. And during the course of the show, they revealed to him that he descended from someone brought aboard this very ship.
Oh my
and
goodness.
Then they showed him a picture of the man and said, "That's your great, great, great grandfather." Questlove stares at him for a minute and says, "Those are my eyes." And sure enough, they were. I mean, it was like looking at a picture of Questlove, looking at this man who lived 150 years ago, and just seeing the emotion it brought to him really educated me in like the significance of this find, if this is proven to be the ship.
We just have about 30 seconds left. Tell us how this important piece of history will be protected.
Well, what I hope is that, you know, the archaeologists are getting to work on it now. They're securing permits. I hope that they're able to prove it's the ship and we're able to pull it up out of the water, build a museum in Africatown, and display this incredible piece of our nation's history for everybody to come see.
I sure hope so. What a story. Ben Raines, thank you very much. Reporter for Alabama.com, he discovered the long-lost wreckage of what may be the Clotilda, last slave ship to bring human cargo to
the U.S. Listening to check out the story and watch the video. It's very powerful.
Ben, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, you can get the On Point podcast of our conversation at onpointradio.org. Find us on Twitter and Facebook. Hope you have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.